I'm not rushing you. Just asking. The next step of improvement, is it likely to take place in a day or a week? Eric, go ahead. No, it's not happening tonight, and it probably will happen tomorrow. Oh, maybe Wednesday, Thursday. It all depends upon when I get time, too, so... it'll happen in the next week or two. Did you say you have another standby duplexer ready to roll? And how many targets does it have? It has to be found first. And then it has to be filmed, but, I'll have the answer to that probably tomorrow. I wonder if there's an aging characteristic of a duplexer. When it's brand new and it's got shiny silver plating everywhere, nice tight screws, it's got one kind of performance. And then 5 years downrange, I'll bet you the performance can be a little bit different. Has there ever been any history saying things along those lines, Eric?
I can give you information in terms of, like, what my mass filters are. They're like the six-pole Chebyshev. The way you look at them, really the best way to look at them is in the time domain rather than the frequency domain. It's much more accurate because you can see each pole independently. But like the ones from the typical antenna manufacturers like Dielectric or ERI and a couple of others, those things are built in such a way that they mechanically don't move. Once you set them 5-10 years down the line, they look exactly the same. This thing is constructed out of those pieces of aluminum that you can slide, interlocking aluminum that you can slide together and, you know, make a top plate and a bottom plate and bolt it all together. But the screws are, you know, the aluminum, because of aluminum, the thermal constant is a little wider than, say, solid copper or some other brass-type material. And the screws that they use, really, they don't thread with a die and tap. They use essentially look like self-tapping screws to hold it together. So I suspect there's a little mechanical motion over time.
Understand. Thermal expansion and so on, and some mechanical motion. If there were real blind fasteners, really threaded screws, nuts and bolts, with lock washers, I think that would be more reliable than a self-tapping screw that's holding together a critical RF grounded assembly. The base of the cavity, where the reentrant rod hits ground, you'd like to have all of those contacts in the very small number of micro-ohms if you can get it. Milli-ohms are not tolerable in that situation, in my opinion. And as aluminum oxide builds up and the thermal cycling of that self-tapping screw can make those micro-ohms become milli-ohms, and your tuning can change. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. Keep your eyes open.
I can kind of see that, but the way it's constructed, we're talking about screws that are really large and have a lot of grab area. You know, we're not talking about 832s. We're talking about things that are bigger than 1024s. Even sadder than that. It's not the same philosophy as a typical can, which is really a round piece of pipe. And the bottom is brazed on, the top is brazed on, and it's, you know, it's literally welded together. This thing you can take apart. Although they do use aluminum weld in various places. But, you know, just the experience of it being there, something about it drifts. You know, the actual tuning rods themselves are made out of copper. I don't consider that to be an issue, but the body of the thing itself, I think if you were to measure it in micrometers, you'd probably see it's changed.
Do you have any fear of about an aluminum weld changing its characteristic in time, building up aluminum oxide at the edges? I guess an aluminum weld done with SEARC can be very reliable. I know that aluminum soldering that I've done in the past, particularly when it's exposed outdoors, tends to have a very short lifetime. Over to you, Eric, KQRIW.
Yeah, I
would
agree with you. This is indoors. You know, it's not in a human environment. It's always dry. And I've never seen any indication of aluminum oxide on it in anywhere, any space. It's very clean looking. I suspect that they actually put some kind of a, you know, after they assemble it, some kind of a lacquer on it to keep the environment away from it.
Yeah, aluminum is always going to build up aluminum oxide. And even a lacquer coating slows down the rate but doesn't stop it. So right now, do you favor retuning what you've got as opposed to putting in a brand new duplexing filter? Do you think the first step is more likely to be the way to go?
Now, as you know, a 600 kilohertz filter tends to be pretty expensive. And we did actually buy this one a bunch of years ago, and it has served us very reliably. Every 3 or 4 years, yeah, so you got to tweak it. You know, you can tag that under routine maintenance.
That makes a lot of sense. Each time you tune it up, what you guess, you're able to squeeze out another 10 dB of isolation when you go through the tuning procedure, restore it by 10 or 15 dB.
I think the last time the number was something like 12 or 15 in that neighborhood. I mean, it wasn't that far, but it was enough to be annoying. So, to do it again, the problem will go away. And then somebody else can deal with it in another 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, the amplitude of the transmitter signal getting you to the receiver is right at the threshold of creating descents. A 12 dB improvement could make a huge improvement. Okay. Good luck with that tuning procedure. Rarely does a instrument, spectrum analyzer, service monitor, vector network analyzer, rarely do any of those instruments have enough direct dynamic range to be able to view the isolation in one step. Usually you have to go through multiple steps to really see the isolation. Is that true with your tuning procedure, Eric? KE2EJ, KQIW?
Okay, what do you mean by one step? Are we talking about distance and amplitude, or are we talking about a procedure that you do a course and a fine?
If this is the best of all worlds, I could take the sampling of the transmitter power into, say, a spectrum analyzer, set that at the top of the screen, and then look at the amount of that signal that gets through the isolation, and hopefully it's going to be at the bottom of the screen, 100 dB lower, if the screen's got 100 dB of dynamic range. If that was the best of all worlds, and you had a testing instrumentation with enough dynamic range, that would be a nice way to go. Rarely do you have that much leeway on the top and the bottom to be able to see that directly. Usually other attenuators and bypassing and whatever has to be done in between in order to simulate the isolation in a two-step process. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
KQRIW, KQEJ. Yeah, a lot of instruments don't go down to minus 120. But there are some tricks that can be played in terms of, you know, increasing gain. But the reality is, most guys will tune the duplexes. You will, you know, terminate the other end, put your transmitter signal in it, and adjust the null on the receive side to minimize the RF passing through it. And there are some service monitors that let you kind of simulate, you know, minus 120 in terms of by blowing up the bottom where you are, where they don't care about the added noise and phase distortion, where it's just, you know, you can see more, so to speak, while you're tweaking, because you're doing only one half at a time. At least if I set it up with my VNA, I can actually have all three ports running all at the same time and visible on the screen all at the same time.
So with the three-port VNA, I think you're telling me you can simultaneously tune for the minimum insertion loss between antenna and receiver and minimum insertion loss between the transmitter and the antenna. At the same time, you're looking at the isolation between transmitter and receiver. So I think you're telling me you can see all three at once with three displays, three different colors on the screen. Is that roughly true, Eric? K2REW?
Yeah, well, I think you know the VNA we're talking about, the roadie. They give you the facilities to do that, where you can actually separate the source from the detector and isolate them all and hook them up how you choose.
A very nice machine. Okay, one last call. Was there anybody who wanted to sign in for the question and answer period of the TechNet? Give me a call that is a name right now. K2REW.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, the name is Rich.
Whiskey 2. Okay, I got Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, Rich. Who was the other person? Give me a call letters and name.
Yeah, Dick, it's KC2SHO John in Los Alamos.
Very fine, John. We'll pick you up right after Rich. W2, Bravo Zulu, go right ahead, Rich. Dick, here's Rich.
Well, it's Rich east of Ohio and Dick until the Rocky Mountains, and then in L.A. it's Kiddo. Anyway, I've been dying. I apologize. I don't get back soon enough from what I do on Sunday evenings to check in. I've been dying to ask a couple of questions. One happens to be about an antenna farm that has been bugging me for years out here on the East End. Let me drop. Okay, this antenna farm is at the intersection of Route 105 and what's that road now called that goes past Gabreski Airport? Old Riverhead Road. So you go over Sunrise Highway if you're heading north, and there's a traffic circle now when you hit Route 105. Right in front of you, there is this huge antenna farm with towers, whatever the government legal limit is, not ham radio towers, so I don't know what those... There's about six towers with wires strung, looking like in a rhombic position, and I've never seen anything bigger in my life, and I wonder if anybody really knows what that is.
Okay, you haven't given us quite enough words other than the fact that the towers are very big and there's a lot of wires on them. Any chance you can give us a photograph someday of that particular installation, Rich? Go ahead.
Well, it's hard to because it's hidden, except for the height of it, it's hidden by woods. You know, it looks like, you know, a rhombic with, you know, huge elements between two or three towers, and then it tapers down. That's as much as you can see, and there's no access to it. Well, there is access to it, but you have to go through a locked fence. So, you know, it could be air traffic control, it could be something else, but I just wondered if anybody knew exactly what it was. So that's question number one, and yes, I could send a picture of it, or anybody could look it up on, you know, Google Maps. Let me drop. Question two. Is Dick, you said repeatedly, I talked to Roy about this, but you've said that, coax couplers virtually have no discernible loss. Is that correct?
With reasonable construction and brand name, all connectors, all adapters have no real loss. when it comes to a coaxial transmission line, the only thing that gives you loss is significant length. 100 feet of transmission line, no matter how you construct it, is going to have some number of decibels of loss because of its length, and you're getting X number of dB per 100 feet of insertion loss. Every single type N connector, BNC connector, UHF connector, AT, 716 connector, all of these connectors we use are in most cases less than an inch long. Unless you built it out of carbon granules, it can't have loss. People think that each individual connector has half a dB of loss, particularly UHF connectors. I mean, people believe each UHF connector, because of the wrong impedance inside, have got all kinds of loss. I personally have taken a pair of UHF connectors, a female-to-female adapter and a pair of male adapters meeting it, and fed at 432 700 watts key-down power through that assembly for 5 solid minutes. At the end, let me drop. At the end of the 5 minutes, that assembly of those two, of those three connectors altogether, the assembly had mildly warm touch. If I calculated mildly warm touch as a watt of dissipation, 2 watts of dissipation, out of 700 watts, you do that calculation as something like 0.01 dB of insertion loss. So connectors, everybody believes every connector and every adapter has loss. I don't know where the hell that old wives' tale got started, but everybody tells it to each other, and because they hear it so many times, they believe it's the truth. You actually go and make the measurement. There ain't no loss. Within reason. I mean, hundredths of a dB, sometimes up as high as a tenth of a dB, maybe. But there's half a dB per connector? No way, Jose. Oh, you, Bob. I mean, Rich. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2IW.
So, now what if I do this? Of coax, the 50 feet, 100 feet, and anywhere along it, I cut it in two. And then what I do is I strip back the outer Hold on 1 second. I just strip back the outer casing. I strip back the braid, and then I strip back the center conductor, and just about, let's say, a 16th of an inch on either side. And then I solder those two center conductors together as closely as I can get them, so there's not such a big gap in the dielectric. And then I solder the braid as close as I can get those two and wrap that up in electrical tape. What then?
If you've got 100 feet of cable, and for some reason you want to break the middle of it, why not install a, let me pick the number, a type N connection on each cable, and put between the two a female-to-female type N adapter? Why not put real connectors, properly installed, right at that point? What's stopping you from doing that, Rich? Go ahead.
It's purely a theoretical question, compared to no or very little loss with a connector to soldering it back together. It's completely theoretical.
Okay. I guess you're saying somebody has come along with a great big slicing machine of some kind. In the middle of your 100 feet of coax, they've sliced the cable so there's now two separate pieces. And you have no access to any kind of a connector. Now you want to reconnect those two pieces by the best job you can do by splicing the center conductor and soldering it, and then bringing the braid together on the outside and soldering it, and hopefully putting some dielectric in there so that there's not an impedance bump. I guess you're asking me, if you're skilled enough, could you put that back together so that on your time domain reflectometer, you had a very small perturbation at that point? If you're skilled enough, could you do that? The answer is yes. At least you could make it work up to at least 2 meters if you're skilled. I'm not sure you're going to get good performance at 1296 because the size requirements of the perturbation starts becoming very small when the wavelengths become very small. Over to you, Rich, K2IW.
when you use the word skills, you mean how close you can get the solder connectors to work, you know, either side, how close you can get either side soldered together and then the braid soldered together. That's what you mean by the skill of it?
I think it is. If you properly prepare the cable on each end, you're first going to be soldering the center conductor and putting some kind of a dielectric material around it. And then the remaining braid, which you've made sure was long enough because you had to push it back in a funny way when you were preparing the cable, now you can interweave the individual sections of that braid on the outside before resoldering it. That's part of the skill of what I'm talking about. You know the way you would do a splice of two pieces of rope? Well, you can splice the braid on the outside of the cable in a similar manner if you're sufficiently skilled. Over to you, Rich, K2LAW.
Okay, well, that answers that, but you're saying you actually have to be skilled to weave the braids together, I guess, rather than just, you know, twirling them in your fingers and then soldering them together. Okay, that answers that. The other question I've been dying to ask you, you know, you've been saying for a very long time, breaking everything that I ever knew, but I believe you. And that is that just about any antenna could be brought into resonance with a good antenna tuner and proper other techniques. Is there a limit to that? I have a vertical dipole, 2 meters right now, stuck into a tree about 15 feet up. And I'm wondering, can I take the end of that coax, put it into a tuner, and put that into my Kenwood 440 and get on the low band? In other words, does your theory stop at some length? Go ahead.
I'm going to back up to the previous question. Rather than having to braid and re-braid the outer copper portion of the coax cable, you could, after connecting the center conductor and the dielectric material, slip in a piece of thin-walled copper tubing of the right outside and inside diameter, slip that in there, and now lay the braid on each end on top of the copper tubing and solder that all together. So you could make a poor man's connector out of thin-walled copper tubing to do a better job of reinstating the outer shield of the coax cable. Now, when it comes to can any antenna, well, let's first start off with John Krause's article, the particular appropriate chapter in the first edition of his book called Antennas. McGraw-Hill, 1950, the book by John Krause called Antennas. Let me drop.
Alma mater, by the way.
Glad to hear it. He has a section called the infinitesimal dipole. If you are skilled enough with doing impedance matching with low insertion loss circuits, an infinitesimal dipole, like a tenth of a wavelength long instead of a half wavelength long, can give you full gain and full performance at one frequency at a time, the one you've tuned it to. It's going to be very narrow band, very high in Q, but you could make a dipole a tenth of a wavelength long with the right kind of impedance matching device at the end, because the dipole itself is going to be 5,000 ohms of capacitor reactance and a resistive component of 1 ohm. That's what you're going to have with a tenth of a wavelength dipole. By looking at the Brown and Woodward curves, you can find out exactly what the impedance is going to be for your diameter of wire for that infinitesimal dipole. As you make a dipole go from half wave down to infinitesimal in length, you never lose more than half a dB of potential gain. Never more than half a dB. And the half a dB of gain loss is not a loss of insertion loss, it's a loss because the antenna pattern, the dipole, the sonar pattern, becomes a little bit fatter because of the shorter length. So it's the change in pattern that makes the half a dB loss. So if you can make a dipole a tenth of a wavelength long and give you full performance within half a dB of the full length dipole, obviously that concept can be applied to almost any antenna. Let me drop. Now, there's two caveats here.
the tuning network that's going to give you the impedance match from 50 ohms into that dipole, which is an infinitesimal dipole. It's starting off with a 100-to-1 standing wave ratio, and you put a very low loss, high performance impedance matching network in there to re-resonate it and re-impedance match it. You're now going to end up with an extremely high Q. The high Q means that if you QSY on 10 meters, you QSY 20 KC, you're going to have to retune the structure. It's going to be that narrow band. Second of all, you're limited as to how much power you can put into it, because that infinitesimal dipole still has to radiate the 100 watts you want to put into it. And the voltage at the tips are going to get to numbers like 5,000 volts, and it's going to arc over. So you're going to be power limited because you're not putting it into a perfect vacuum, and you're going to arc over the air. And you're going to be bandwidth limited by the laws of increased Q because of the impedance matching network. But except for those two caveats, you can get full performance out of a dipole of any size. Lots of people will challenge you on that one. I mean, in order for it to have within half a dB the exact same gain, I'm now trying to tell you that a dipole that's a tenth of a wavelength long is still going to have the same effective capture area. Let me drop it. At first, that sounds crazy. Your eye sees a hell of a lot less metal in the air on an infinitesimal dipole. How in the world can it have the same amount of effective capture area, which is required for it to have the same gain within half a dB? And that's the magic of resonance. The fact that you've got an extremely high Q resonance means that there's a huge local magnetic field around that infinitesimal dipole that's making up that effective capture area that your eye cannot see, but that radio wave sees it and responds to it. Ain't that crazy? Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich.
It's more than crazy. It sounds like magic, but you know, I don't know what you guys know, but what I do know is I'm hitting the Zelda machine from Riverhead with 5 watts on a 2-meter dipole, vertical dipole. Each element is 19 and a quarter inches long, just fed straight with RG58U. So you're saying that what I can do with this antenna now is plug it into a tuner and then plug that tuner into my Kenwood 440 and go on 80 meters? Is that what you're saying? Because I will try it.
Hold on now. That antenna tuner you're talking about must be located at the antenna. You put the antenna tuner in the shack at the other end of the coax cable, no way, Jose. When that antenna is running that infinitesimal dipole that has a 100-to-1 standing wave ratio, if you try to feed that to any reasonable length of reasonable transmission line, that 100-to-1 standing wave ratio with the signal bouncing back and forth thousands of times in that transmission line is going to build up a tremendous amount of insertion loss, even if your antenna tuner in the shack is perfect. The antenna tuner, the impedance matching network, must be located at the antenna. Do that and use reasonable transmission line from there down to the receiver or the transceiver. Yes, it will work like a charm. As long as that antenna tuner has high enough quality to have low enough insertion loss when it is impedance matching something that bad. It's a very rare antenna tuner that has enough tuning range to be able to re-resonate a tenth of a wavelength dipole. But if your particular antenna tuner has that ability, and by the way, you could homebrew that, you could make that impedance matching network at one frequency by using the Berkeley formula, if you know what I mean. You go to Berkeley and impedance match. Google the word Berkeley and impedance match. And by way of the Brown and Woodward curves, you know how long and what diameter is the wire of your infinitesimal dipole. Let me drop it. By way of the Brown and Woodward curves, you can predict the exact impedance of your infinitesimal dipole. Plug that into the Berkeley formula as the load. Plug in 50 ohms as the source, and ask Berkeley to give you an impedance matching LC network in between the two, and you install that LC network as long as you've used good quality inductor and capacitor for that L pair that I just described. That's one of the 15 solutions that Berkeley will give you. you synthesized that thing out of good materials and located right at the antenna, you will get the performance I'm talking about. It'll be extremely narrow band. It won't take very many watts before it arcs over. But with those two restrictions, it will fly. Over to you, Rich, K2IW.
So it sounds like these would be monoband tuners for one frequency where you actually wouldn't have to tune anything. It would be pre-tuned for one frequency on a band, and if you wanted to go from 80 to 40 to 20, blah, 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 you would put up a different matching network, correct?
Yes, and if you're mechanically smart enough, you can make a great big turret tuner that plugs in the right impedance matching network at the right time when you're on that particular band. Over to you, Rich.
Well, except for the fact that it has to be right at the antenna, where the coax feeds into the, each half of the dipole, now I understand. And I'm surprised if they don't make things like that commercially, where if you want to go on 80 between, you know, this killer cycle and that killer cycle, we'll buy this thing, put it up on any length of vertical or horizontal dipole, and you're on the air. I'd be surprised if there's nothing like that, but you've answered my question. Now I know. K2RIWW2BZ.
Very fine, Rich. Good question. John, KC2SHO, go right ahead with your question or comment. And how are those electrons, how are those bosons behaving out there in Los Alamos? KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO, great net as always. Although I think I've changed my mind on what I'm going to talk about here. Based on the last conversation, the question I may pose to the engineers that I work with. And the protons are behaving the same as they always do all over the universe, which is good because that means laws we have written down are still working just fine. I'm going to let up just for a second, and then I'll give my comment.
Yeah, I didn't say photons. I said bosons. Bravo, bosons. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, that's a good question, and that might be one more for the guys over at CERN, although we just got an engineer here who came over from CERN, so looking forward to it. My comment to you is we transmit 2 to 3 megawatts into the cavities of the LINAC at 201.25 megahertz. These are very short little stub loops at the end of the transmission line at the cavity. So what occurred to me during the conversation this evening about resonance, if I'm interpreting what I know and what I'm hearing correctly, so we're kind of doing the opposite. Instead of the tuner being before the antenna because of the resonance of the tank, of the cavity, that this inductance and capacitance and other things that are making this extremely high Q circuit work. Is that a correct assumption there? K2RIW, KC2.
If I had a small device, like a small stub, that's attempting to launch a signal between a transmission line and a cavity, the length and diameter of that stub, the location in the cavity, makes a huge difference as to what impedance you see looking into that stub from the outside world at the outside connector. The cavity itself, its size and its resonances, acting as a coupled device to that stub, means that they complement each other. Depending on the tuning of the cavity, its dimensions, and the location of your stub, and the length and diameter of the stub and its orientation, even though the stub itself may be only a 16th of a wavelength long, for some reason you've got to have it small, you could, in that environment, by adjusting the parameters that are at your disposal, you could make that a perfect impedance match at least one frequency at a time. Is that sort of the question you're asking, John? Over to you, K2LAW.
WKC2, yes, Dick, I believe we are saying the same thing. We are setting up an RF field inside a very large cavity and PO somewhere around 2 to 3 megawatts, depending which module we're discussing. And there's just a small coupling loop at the input, at the end of this 14-inch coaxial line, just a small little loop there, and that's setting up the field inside the cavity, and the resonance of the cavity is controlled for load tuners, temperature control. So trying to wrap my head around why, or what the method, what the mechanism is that's allowing that high Q thing match to have that resonance. Size, obviously, of the cavity is very important, hence the correction from the tuners that move in and out based on the measured temperature. We are saying the same thing. KC2.
The cavity tuners that are part of a duplexing filter, or they can be part of a bandpass filter. Whenever you study a microwave-like filter, you'll find out that in almost all cases, it is a particular length of a kind of transmission line with a short circuit at one end and a short or an open at the other end, and a signal bouncing back and forth that stays coherent on each of those bounces. That's what a cavity is. It's a transmission line with an extremely high reflection coefficient on each end, and the signal bounces back and forth between the two. And you're launching a signal in there that is a little bit similar to what's happening when you're pushing your child on a swing. You're pushing the child in synchronism. The child has a certain resonant frequency swinging back and forth on that swing, and on each forward motion, you give that person a push and you're adding energy to that resonant system. So every cavity resonator is either a coaxial transmission line or an open cavity type of transmission line, like a piece of waveguide, but still the piece of waveguide can be analyzed as a kind of transmission line. You put a short circuit at each end and a launching probe in the right location, and you've now got an extremely high Q resonator, as long as the insertion loss of the signal bouncing back and forth in the thing that you call a cavity, as long as that insertion loss is very low, coming up with a Q of 1,000 or 5,000 is very doable. Does that make some sense, John? Over to you, K2LAW.
Yeah, yes it does. And I guess I hadn't thought about it from the waveguide aspect of it. So you're saying very similar thing is happening when you launch into the waveguide?
Okay, now, when you talk about a real waveguide, are you talking about the tube that's part of an accelerator, the ring of the accelerator, or are you talking about these megawatts you're putting in? Are you trying to put some kind of material in this cavity and expose it to megawatts, or is this a launching mechanism for an accelerator? That's not quite clear to me yet, John, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, I should have clarified that. Yes, I am talking about the accelerator and launching into the accelerator to set up the field. This is the energy that accelerates the proton beam.
Okay, in my opinion, it's very likely that your launching structure for that proton beam is a cavity resonator. Although, after you've done the launch, I presume there's a fraction of a mile of cavity downrange that the protons are going to circulate into, and now try to describe the resonance of that fraction of a mile long thing. That's becoming a little bit more difficult. But the launching structure, I guess it is the equivalent of a feed horn. Whether you're launching a signal into space with a horn, or whether you're launching protons into a circulator, I see a strong correlation between the two. Over to you, John, KQLAW.
Yeah, again, this may be a discussion I have with my direct supervisor, who is the engineer and designer of the RF transmitters we use now. And this will be a discussion we'll have tomorrow, I guess is what I'm getting at, and see what he has to tell me about it. I do know, again, it's not as long as you say, because there's many modules, so each module has its own transmitter. If you look up on YouTube, if anybody listening is curious about how accelerators work, you can look up DTL, which is drift tube. Drift tube LINAC is really what it stands for, and LINAC is just linear accelerator. And you can see some graphical representations of how this works. So at this accelerator, there's four modules of 201 megahertz DTL, which is drift tube LINAC. Then there's 44 modules of side coupled LINAC, which is a 805 megahertz. And you can see a lot of this right on our website. If you look up LANSC, L-A-N-S-C, if you go to Los Alamos' website, there should be a link out to that as well. But it's the LANSC facility at Los Alamos. You can find lots of interesting information about how it all works. Nothing about the accelerator and how it functions is really anything that's of full information. You know, the operation of the accelerator is pretty well published.
K2IW, KC2, and H2. So each of those modules along this linear accelerator is a little bit like the Stanford linear accelerator. So in other words, the signal doesn't go in a circle, it goes in one path. But as it passes each module, it experiences a little bit more boost to get more and more energy to the beam. Is that what's going on, John?
Yes, so I guess there's lots of different types of accelerators. I don't know them all. But this is a linear accelerator, so it's all just along a linear line. I think we're half a mile or nearly a mile, something like that is our total length. And we do peel that signal off and send it around a proton storage ring, a PSR. That's what it's called, the proton storage ring. And there they can kind of bunch them up and make different size packets and do different experiments from there as well. So we do have a storage ring as well, but nowhere near the size of like a CERN. You know, they're that dude that's just miles around, ours is just a few hundred feet or something like that. K2RW, KC2, SHL.
What's the maximum energy of the particles that you're able to launch, John?
They advertise 800 MeV.
And I guess we're talking about 7.5 DeV of LHC, is that true?
Well, you might not be talking to the right guy to go much further than what I've already told you, because I'm not that up on all of this, and definitely not engineering level to know all the way the accelerator works. You know, I kind of just take care of RF equipment that feeds the LINAC and try to absorb as much as I can in my other free time, because it's all very interesting. But I don't have an answer for you, unfortunately, on that one.
So you're maintaining some of these transmitters that make up these modules? Is that part of what you're doing, John?
That's correct. My high-power TV background brought me here. And again, our modules in 201, which is the 201 megahertz team, which is the first four DTL modules, they're capable of, we got two diacrodes combined together. Each diacrode is capable of doing 3 megawatts each, but we really don't drive total energy out of the combiner past 3 megawatts, just to keep everything nice and happy. So we do have six, at the current state, we have 6 3-megawatt diacrodes. Two of each in each module is combined together. Somewhere between 2 and 3 megawatts is the average, I should say the nominal power, depending which module we're talking about.
A couple of times you've used the word diacrode. That's a new one on me. Give me a few words on what is a diacrode. Is that a kind of a Klystron-like vacuum tube, but go ahead.
Yes. The diacrode is just a double-ended tetrode. So it's a double-ended coaxial tetrode. So you're just getting twice the power out of each tube. Instead of needing two, they're both kind of connected together, if I understand it correctly. And
The rest of the Atlantic 3805, that is Klystron. So we have 44 Klystrons after that.
And I presume these Klystrons are running at something like 50 kilovolts each?
Yeah, I do believe their high voltage is somewhere around 50, that's right. Where we run around 22 on the diagram.
And the power you're getting out of it, I presume it's a brief pulse of power. This is not CW power, is that true?
Yes, that's correct. CW would be a much derated value over what I'm telling you. So we pulse about 120 hertz and one microsecond.
So you're putting out 3 megawatts of power for 1 microsecond, and you do that procedure 120 times per second is what I think you're saying. I presume all those modules downrange are running on the equivalent of a frequency synthesizer to make sure that all of the signals that they're generating are properly synchronized so that in all cases you're aiding energy to the beam that's going through them. Is that approximately what's happening there, John?
That is correct, and it's a touchy game, if I understand correctly, to make all that happen. There's frequency references that are fed down the whole mile, you know, and that is really the core of the reference system. Not only that, but these lines have a temperature compensation system to them that is actually a moving coupler basically between each more rigid piece of line to help keep the phase drift down.
So you're trying to match phases to the nearest 1 or 2 degrees is a good guess on my part on all of the individual modules so that the signal always adds in a vector manner to add energy to the beam. Go ahead.
That's correct. You got it. And it's interesting if you look at like how the Japanese accelerator works. They use a, I'm guessing it's an RF over fiber system, but they use fiber optics to get it done. It's a much more modern design as our accelerator here is just about as old as I am, 40 years counting.
And when it comes to the phase shifting to make sure everything turns out synchronous with the downrange modules, are you saying it's a mechanical sliding assembly that does that phase adjusting? Is that what you were suggesting earlier?
Yeah, completely mechanical, no interaction from anything else. As the coaxial line expands and contracts with temperature, there are sliding couplers. Every so often, I forget how many feet I read about it, well over a year ago when I first started, it's fascinating, about how the source and reference line work. But yeah, every so often they just have a sliding coupler. It moves around as temperature causes those materials to expand and contract.
And each of those couplers is kind of a servo mechanism. There's a motor being fed as a servo mechanism to do that sliding motion. Go ahead.
Negative, completely passive.
Are you telling me a human being turns a knob in order to do the phase adjusting?
Nope, as the line expands and contracts, the couplers just compensate. They are just a sliding coupler that connects the line. So as one piece of line expands, it doesn't push along the next one. It's just taken up in the coupling section.
It sounds like it's the equivalent of a coaxial connector where you inject the male and female further or less in order to compensate for the equivalent length. Is that sort of what's taking place?
Think of it as a linear banjo, if you know the banjo type, I'm sure you do, the banjo type phase adjusters. This is just a linear version of that, really, that's completely controlled by, is completely reactive to the expansion and contraction.
Now, the thing that's being compensated, is it the synchronizing line or the actual vacuum that the particles are moving down? What is really expanding that has to be compensated?
Just the reference line. It feeds the RF reference to all of the modules for frequency stability.
Yeah, in theory, that could have been done electronically. Okay. You got a fascinating job out there, John. I think it's way beyond the time we should be switching over to the science report. So, AC2GS, please come forward. You got it, Roy, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. I just want to get a signal report, make sure that I'm not too noisy.
You're sounding quite good, but 10% of the time there's a blast of noise. That's only a couple of dB weaker than your voice. So please proceed. For the people who are doing a little bit careful listening, they will get every one of your words. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good. I have my little linear amplifier running in the background, and it'll be interesting to see if this duty cycle overheats it. Last time it did, but I bought a automated fan assembly. So, I am AC2GS, and this is the Science Talk, and once again, if you have any topics or suggestions or comments, feel free to email them to me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And everything that I talk about is going to be put on a web page where you can click the links and get further information. And that web page is roy.ac2gs.com. In addition to what I've been talking about tonight, or we'll talk about tonight, I also included a nice little video from Ham Whiskey 6 Lima Golf. He did a very nice YouTube on connecting about 12, 15, 16 different connectors, hooking it up to a watt meter and showing that the watt meter read just about the same output. So it's a very nice visual experiment that kind of proves the concept that connectors don't really have much in the way of an insertion loss. Let me drop. In addition, I don't know... you got email from Paul. He sent me some Google searches, and it's that image looks a lot like what's being called a shot spotter or a spot shooter or something along those lines. But it sounds like it might not be a permanent design, but it probably is to detect gunshots as well. And just touching very lightly on accelerators, you know, there are linear accelerators, there are ring accelerators. They haven't used electrostatic forces for acceleration since the 30s. It's all been through RF. And one of the latest, greatest developments in linear accelerators is something called a Wakefield accelerator, which apparently is some phenomena of plasma wake to make the acceleration much greater. Presently can for a given length of linear acceleration. So accelerators are fascinating things, and they're fascinating tools to teach us things. Let me drop for a second. Okay, I have a bunch of little short topics. They're more of addendums to what I discussed in the last few weeks. The first one is, unfortunately, about flu season and flu vaccines. The CDC's reported that a child in Florida died of influenza B, so she seems to be the first pediatric victim for this year. It's rather unusual that it was influenza B, but that sometimes happens. So please, once again, strongly consider the flu vaccine. It is a dead vaccine. It contains no live influenza virus, so you can't really catch influenza from it. It doesn't convey 100% immunity, you know, 40, 50% is better than nothing. And it does take a few weeks for it to develop an immunity in your blood. So you can't just take the shot and go into a place filled with guys with the flu and expect it to do much. So keep those things in mind. Really think about it. And probably it would be a great idea if you get your flu shot real soon. Let me drop for any questions or comments. AC2GS.
WS2N.
Paul.
I've seen a couple of articles about this one disease that apparently kids are getting it. I don't think an adult can get it. It's AFM, that's the abbreviation acute flaccid my lightest, I guess it is. And they're the articles are claiming that a vaccine may be, is behind it. I'm not too sure about that. It doesn't sound right, according to what you're saying. That probably can't happen. But I wonder if you've seen that. Very rare. Apparently, it affects the, you have your regular nervous system, your central nervous system, and your peripheral. Apparently, it's affecting the central nervous system and the spine. Back to you.
Yes, Paul. It's called acute flaccid myelitis. It's a relatively rare condition. Affects people's nervous systems, especially their spinal column, giving a weakness of in one or more limb. People aren't quite sure what causes it. It could be viruses. It could be environmental toxins. It could be a genetic disorder. It's really up in the air, and it sounds vaguely reminiscent of Guillain-Barré, which caused a lot of fright early on in flu vaccines in the 70s or so. There was a big breakout in it, and people didn't quite know what caused it. Still aren't 100% sure. But, is it possible? I guess. You can't prove a negative, unfortunately, but there's more than enough examples of people who just flat out die from influenza disease rather than the vaccination. As I reported last week, it was about 80,000 people last year, and there's already one kid in Florida. So in a perfect world, it would be nice if we didn't have to vaccinate ourselves against any diseases, but we don't live in a perfect world.
Okay, because, a few weeks ago, maybe a month now, time gets away from me. Sanjay Gupta, a CNN doctor, I think he's a neurologist, I'm pretty sure. But he had a piece about this particular problem, and he said it affected the kids, but he was pointing possibly to a DNA connection. So, okay, very good, Roy. I'll let you continue.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Sanjay Gupta is a neurosurgeon. And as I said, it might be a genetic disorder. It might be a neurotoxin disorder. It's so early in research that they don't really know even what caused it. So I would hate to have people jump to the conclusion that it's something as important and useful as influenza vaccines as the cause. But everyone makes their own decision and lives by the consequences, right? My next little addendum is about the story that I mentioned about the iconoclastic street artist Banksy. If you recall, I mentioned his million-dollar work of art that partially got shredded after being sold at a recent Sotheby's auction. Well, apparently Banksy released a bunch of videos on Instagram, and in them he suggested that he had actually meant to shred the entire canvas, but apparently the gears jammed or something happened and it got stuck about a third of the way into the gears, and so only a third were sliced to little strips. One strange thing about Banksy is sometimes I think the guy just trolls people, because included in the video was the preparation of the shredding device, in which it's clearly shown some person is holding a soldering iron and seemingly doing some work off camera, but they're holding the soldering iron by the hot portion of the iron. So I don't know if it was just a prop picture or he was having a joke on us. So you got to treat Banksy with more than a grain of salt. Despite that, once again, we don't quite know if Sotheby's had anything, any knowledge before it, and the guy, I think it was a woman, who bought the artwork, still wants to keep it. She thinks it's gone up in price. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Okay, on to the next. About a couple of months ago, I mentioned that there was this work of art in a museum in Spain. It basically looked like a very inky black circle drawn on the ground, about 3 foot in diameter. And it was roped off, and there were caution signs, but despite that, a nice Italian gentleman visiting on a vacation stepped into the 3-foot circle and plummeted down 8 feet where the artist's hole finally ended. This was artwork of a gentleman by the name of Anesh Kapoor. He has painted that hole the blackest black he could find. He's later gone on to license a